Five centuries ago, in taverns and public houses across Europe, the masses would gather for discussion and debate over the latest ideas sweeping the land. From one such meeting place, a small Cambridge inn called the White Horse, the Reformation came to the English-speaking world. Carrying on the tradition, welcome to the White Horse Inn.
Welcome to the White Horse Inn. I'm Ken Jones, and I'll be your host today for this very special broadcast. Now, we happen to be in Atlanta attending the Alliance of Confessing Evangelicals National Pastors Conference to interview some of the speakers and musicians who are taking part in this particular conference. Today, we'll be discussing the influence of gospel music in worship, and it's our honor to have vocalist and composer Ruth Naomi Floyd as our very special guest. Now, Ruth is best known for her ability to blend freeform jazz aesthetics inspired in the gospel tradition. I don't know of a more qualified guest to join me and Councilmember John Nunes for this broadcast on gospel music in worship than Ruth. So welcome and enjoy the program. As we open the discussion, when we talk about the Black Church, there's a certain characteristic. Now, Ruth, you've sung, I know, in Anglo churches. Do you sing the same in a white church as you would in a Black church?
Well, it depends in what context. If it's a worship service, certainly. And the point of my participation musically is to point people to Jesus. I make sure that I'm well aware of what the music director is doing. So the answer is yes and no.
Okay.
Because I'm also classically trained.
Right.
So thankfully, I've been able to dive in both areas.
Now, if you were in your Black Baptist church at home,
mm-hmm.
and you were singing, what's one of your favorite hymns to sing as a solo?
Holy, holy, holy.
Holy, holy, holy. Now, can you put a little flavor in it?
Absolutely.
Okay, so do you sing it the same do you sing it the same in your Black home church as you would, say, in 10th Presbyterian?
Absolutely not.
Okay. See, and that difference, that flavor, that essence, something that we can't touch, but it's a reality.
It's a cultural reality and a historical reality.
Now, let me ask you, John, being the theologian as you are, is it something that can be problematic in the Black church?
I think, you know, every cultural group is given to certain pathologies, certain excesses, certain silent sins that go unaddressed. And the problem, I think, can become in the Black church where the style, the way the preacher says it, the way the singer sings it, can take precedence over the substance,
right?
The meat of the message. So the gravy can matter more than the meat.
Mm. Well, let's continue on the issue of music, because music is a very big part of the Black worship experience. Now, Ruth, do you sing spirituals, Negro spirituals?
Absolutely.
What can you tell us about a little bit about the history of some of those spirituals?
Well, first of all, African-American spiritual is really the purest form, one of the purest forms of American music. It's really the root of so many different styles of music. When the Africans were brought to this land, the first thing that was taken away from them historically, when you look, is the drum. Because even though they spoke different dialects and different language and different tribal languages, they could all understand this kind of universal drum. And so they were mixed in on different plantations, but they could still understand the beating of that drum, and the plantation owners were wise enough to understand it. So that was taken away. And what happened was is that the slaves started using their bodies even for the communicating still that drum. But the spirituals are really made up of two different things. Certainly theologically, it talks about the hope of Jesus, the hope of liberation, the hope of freedom, both here and the life afterwards in heaven, but also it was a secret coded message.
Right.
So it had this political, social aspect to it. So when you're talking about steal away to Jesus, it was definitely talking about one day I'm going to steal away and I'm going to see him face to face and this life will be over. But also it was also Nat Turner's Alert song. Mm-hmm. So they were also talking about stealing away. So it's this beautiful style of music combined, so many different, it was rich in so many things. And I think also that's still prevalent in today's black music, that when you sing "Oh Freedom" or you sing "Amen" or you sing a different spiritual, it means different things to different people in different aspects of it in the form of worship.
Now, you mentioned the theology that drove most of those spirituals. I think one of the things that is certainly evident in the history of slavery in this country is that when Christianity was introduced to the slaves by, and we really should say reintroduced, because Christianity was present in Africa, but obviously it had been eclipsed over the years by the time of the 17th century.
It's the rise of Islam.
Yes. Yeah. So it had been there. But when it was introduced to the African slaves, that they really did identify with the message of redemption, and particularly with the plight of Israel. And just as the release from Egyptian bondage and captivity was the high point in Old Testament Israel's history, and it was always the calling card, they would return back to that theme quite frequently. The same thing in the slaves, they identified with that Egyptian experience, and they also identified literally with the wilderness experience. Now, how did that shape the theology, John, of the slaves during that period?
It's amazing how, as Ruth has said, how much Jesus really did pervade the sung spirituality, the sung theology of slaves. In the morning when I rise, give me Jesus. And then all through the course of life and the stages of life until finally, oh, when I come to die even, give me Jesus. So there was this tremendous sense of eschatology, this tremendous expectation, this tremendous sense of personhood that wasn't defined or encapsulated in the experience of slavery. Now, some outside observers called it pie in the sky religion.
Right.
But as Ruth Naomi has clearly demonstrated, because of the dual coding, you know, Canaan's fair and happy land was Canada, Canaan, Canada, and all of the dual coding that happened, there was a strong undercurrent then of social justice for the here and now. But it was a both and. It wasn't an either or. Unfortunately, I think we've seen in our time that so-called pie in the sky religion, which it was not, right. It was very much empowering for this life as well.
Yeah, Harriet Tubman, by the way, who was a Christian, who headed up the Underground Railroad, also carried a shotgun.
There you go.
And
yeah.
she shot anyone who turned back.
That's
and,
right.
And to this day, I don't know if
so it was activistic.
Yes.
It was activistic.
It was very
it wasn't
real.
Just resigned to, and before I be a slave, I be buried in my grave, is clearly a song of protest.
Yeah.
But notice how the protest is grounded in the hope of Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
You see, and that's a fundamental difference, I think, a shift we've seen.
Well, you know, one of the historical ironies is that it's been said that the slave owners introduced Christianity to their slaves for the purpose of subduing them.
Of docility.
Yeah.
Yeah, inducing docility.
And instead, it actually provoked a deeper hunger for freedom.
Amen.
Because they couldn't understand how they could be free in Christ, but yet owned by a man. But you mentioned that most of the slaves were illiterate, and they didn't have hymnals. And so one of the leaders would sing the first line, and it could be the same hymn that was sung in a Presbyterian church or in, you know, one of the white churches, but it just took on a life of its own. You know, guide me, O thou great Jehovah, you know, pilgrim through this barren land. And the leader would say it in a certain tune, and then before he finished the last word of that line, everyone else would pick up. And I remember hearing that growing up.
That's a fervent part of my youth. It's what has characterized, Ken, black worship and music from that time till now, this kind of spontaneity. But it wasn't pure spontaneity. It was a planned spontaneity. Everyone knew where they were going. But it had this kind of feel of spontaneity and dialogical kind of worship, where, you know, we see it in black preaching, where there's a dialogue. It's a dialogue.
Exactly.
We see it in black music. We see it in black culture in general. And you're right. This was one of the ways in which they survived and learned the faith.
Call and response.
Call and response. And it was present in the hymn singing as well as in the preaching.
Yes.
See, the preaching by necessity, especially the early preaching of the slaves, because they would teach the one guy and they would let him be the preacher for the slaves. But then they found out that his messages and the songs were, I guess, insubordinate. So they had to sort of preach in the same way they sang. they would sing the hymns. So you really couldn't detect whether they were singing hymns or the man was preaching. And then he could get his message across. And so that's where you had that call and response. And then later it was refined to the hoop.
Yeah.
Now, what's the difference in the gospel music introduced by Thomas Dorsey and the music that was already dominant among the churches?
Well, it started with the spirituals, and then it kind of went into the blues. And one of the greatest misunderstandings is that the blues were secular. And although when you look at the text and the lyrics of the blues, certainly, my man's gone, the man done let me go, I have no food to eat, you know, what am I going to do, I'm all alone. But also, when you really translate and understand what was going on at that time, it wasn't unlike what I call the blues books of the Bible, Job, Lamentations, that there's this still lamenting of loss. So they had experienced, quote-unquote, freedom, but then what could they do with it at that point?
Now, but let me ask you this, Ruth, because you mentioned the criticism that Dorsey and his new twist to black gospel music, that it was criticized for being too secular. But was it secular partly, or have that flavor, partly because of his rhythm and blues background?
Right. I mean, when you look at B.C., Thomas Dorsey's lyrics, I mean, they really rival some of the lyrics.
Well, in fact, jazz itself, the whole word jazz... Yes. When used as a verb, to jazz, has some very sexual connotations.
Right.
And that's
right.
What Dorsey was. Yeah.
Right. So, given that his reputation given, and then this marvelous transformation of him embracing Christ, people were not able to really kind of gear in on the lyrics. They heard the rhythm and the blues. They heard the underlyings. And for them, it really represented something else. And it comes to this whole thing, is there anything so secular that it can't be sacred? Mm-hmm. And that's really what it came down to. And at that point, I think...
Because the people at Pilgrim Baptist Church in Chicago were hearing a club music in church.
Right. But see, that's my point. Was that valid criticism against Dorsey?
I would say yes, and I would say yes because of his background. When I say valid, I mean he had this reputation before, and then he became a Christian, and he started communicating the gospel and the gift of the gospel and this music. And I think we were really put in a position as a people at that time where you had a church on one corner and a jupe joint on another, and it wasn't like you couldn't have both. You were put in a position where you had to choose. And I think that's still going on today.
It is. Yeah. I mean, Kirk Franklin with his hip-hop gospel.
But my point is this, because we've talked about it a lot on this program. Is style neutral, number one? And number two, how much control or how much critique should Scripture have on cultural tendencies? You know, so first, is style neutral? Because what Dorsey attempted to do, yes, he changed his lyrics, but he brought the same music over. It's interesting. You look at Sam Cooke, who happens to be one of my favorite singers. Sam Cooke started as a gospel singer.
Right.
And when he became a secular singer, sang rhythm and blues or pop music, he went back and took some of the very same songs that he sang for gospel, changed the lyrics, but used the same music.
Which is exactly what Aretha Franklin did.
Yes. And she brought
from CL's
black church music,
black church music into the public realm. Right.
Now, my question then is, was Thomas Dorsey's introduction of rhythm and blues or jazz-type music, was it neutral?
But I think Dorsey's more blues.
Right.
And there's a difference between jazz and blues in terms of being vehicles of sacred music.
But the difference here, though, I want to look at is everything that is Christian is not necessarily appropriate for worship. And that's where the real tension came with Dorsey. I listen to your CDs. I find it great music. But I don't think that's the same music you would use in a worship service. And I think that's where the criticism came with Dorsey.
For my music, I wouldn't say that all of it is worship music.
Right.
A couple of them are, but most of it is not. Another good example is Duke Ellington. You know, with his sacred song suites. Mm-hmm. He received the same criticism.
Let's look at another transition, especially in black music or the gospel music. In the 30s and 40s, you had the development of the quartet and the female and male groups, and they would, especially in the South, they would travel the circuits. And some churches where they had circuit preachers, and they didn't have preaching every Sunday, that Sunday afternoon, if there was no preaching, there would be quartets and gospel groups. Now, they would be a derivative, would you say, of the musical influence of Dorsey?
Sure. I mean, it's all connected together. I guess when I look back at some of them, it's really what was the message that they were communicating. And when you listen to some of them, the style, if you took, again, the lyrics away mm-hmm. or the message away from the music, you could say, well, gosh, this could have been a top 40, you know, secular mm-hmm. band or quartet or vocal band at that time. So, yeah, it all kind of, at this point where Dorsey came in and started merging these different styles, it brought forth all different combinations, and that's one of the combinations.
Well, out of that period, black gospel music went to a different dimension also, and it became entertainment.
Right.
And wouldn't you say that would be part of the rise and the prominence of the black gospel choirs, where what I would say in later years, they became the tail that wagged the dog?
Right.
During the 30s and 40s, these quartet singers became celebrities. They went from church to church.
Right.
And as a result of their ability to pull people into the buildings, they replaced the importance of the preacher in many respects
That's
in
right.
the churches.
That's right. Right. That's right. Well, then we have the emergence then of churches that became totally choir-driven.
Exactly.
Like the Reverend Edwin Hawkins Church.
Yes.
In Oakland, California. What do they call it? The
Love
Center.
Love Alive. Let's talk a little bit about how the content of the music changed over the years, because, you know, we talked earlier about the Negro spirituals and how many of them were very sound theologically and biblically. But I think there is a transition, and I think it follows the culture, the evangelical culture, where the churches that had been influenced by revivalism, it carries over into the black church. But here's the thing, with the rise of the quartet and then the emergence of the black gospel choir, didn't that sort of become the signature of the black church, that type of music? So many white evangelicals with a very condescending or patronizing approach would just like some, you know, they like to slum it a little bit, and so they want to hear the flavor of the black music. How did that really, how did that affect the church?
Well, Abyssinian Baptist Church, for example, in New York City, is a regular landmark tourist attraction. Busloads of non-English-speaking visitors to New York City arrive at Abyssinian on Sunday mornings to hear the music. Well, clearly it's not about content there, but it's a spectacle, as you were saying. You know, this became very much an urgent concern for people who were involved in mission work in urban areas in the Lutheran Church mm-hmm. in terms of planting churches or starting churches. And they would often look at what was going on around them and try to plant a church with the choir as a base,
right,
rather than planting a church with the word and the message as a base, with the gospel as a base. And, of course, this is your tail wagging the dog. It's no longer
music. And
that's
music. Where we are now.
It's no longer music and worship in a ministerial relationship to the gospel, but it's music and worship in a magisterial relationship mm-hmm. to the gospel, looking down and over and above the gospel, rather mm-hmm. than the gospel having predominance and worship just serving. You know, in my congregation, we really don't even have a choir. In fact, we just built a church, and we didn't build a choir stand. Mm-hmm. And it's because of some of these tendencies.
Also, too, I think when you look back at history and you look at the Fisk Jubilee Singers, who were going around to raise mm-hmm. money for their college, they were going singing mostly European selections, and the attendance wasn't that great, and the tour wasn't going good. And then one day they just said, we're going to sing our music, our folk songs. And then all of a sudden they're selling out places. So even the spirituals were kind of reintroduced in a kind of concert format without a service, without a kind of worship aspect. And so people started embracing them and saying, wow, this music's wonderful. And they were starting to be performed in places that weren't houses of worship, or where worship was the key.
That's exactly fascinating, Ruth, is how the market then drove the ministry.
Right.
And it became actually, in my mind, Ken, a function of racism. You know, kind of sing for us, dance for us.
Exactly.
You know, entertain us, amuse us, rather than, you know, educate us, uplift us, you know. So then churches then obviously went to where they were encouraged and reinforced.
But then, again, how does this reflect what was going on within the black church? Because in the black churches, white people weren't showing up in droves to hear the choir, but black parishioners were showing up to hear the choir. And even among choir members, as you had so many pop singers that came out of the churches, many of our choirs became auditioning spots.
It's all the fault of the Hammond B3.
There may be some truth to that. Well, let's move to another phase in black gospel music. You mentioned earlier, John, the Hawkins. Was it Edwin Hawkins, mm-hmm. right?
It's the Edwin's Hawkins family singers.
Yeah. Well, that song.
Top 40 hit, number
exactly.
one.
Exactly. Now, right. What was the furor that was stirred up by that song? You want to explain that, either one of you?
I think, again, it was, you can't ignore the marketplace, but also it was the first time where you kind of had this embracement of guitar. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't just, you know, you had drums, guitar. It was really like this combo. And it was, again, if you look secularly what was going on, it was this match of this yeah. kind of music. But it was like, wow, we can really be free in our expression of about our faith in a music that we love and that we can kind of tap our foot to. Or
But see, that was the very issue.
Right.
Because
yes.
the song was introduced to most of us on the radio.
Right.
On secular radio. Programs. And so pastors, I remember in our church, our choir was not allowed to sing Oh Happy Day.
Wow. Really?
We were not allowed to sing Oh Happy Day because it was played on a secular radio station.
What is the theological rationale for that? You know, the classical music radio stations that play Bach are secular music stations,
yeah.
you know.
I think it goes back to this tension of, can something so secular with the music be sacred? And so I think there's that still kind of, we can't have both. We either have to have this one form away, or we can't have this merge.
You know, the Clark sisters, I'm thinking like, you know, that Clark sisters, you know, with You Brought the Sunshine, you know, that was another number one hit. But, you know, Happy Day says, when Jesus washed my sins yeah. away. What a beautiful statement of the gospel. But my question is, Ruth, do you think people heard that?
Yes and no.
Yeah.
But
you
see,
know,
that goes back to
yes
the whole
and no.
issue of the music.
Right.
You know, is style neutral? This is a fascinating discussion. There's so many untouched areas that we could cover, and I'm really happy that we were able to air some of these issues, and I don't think I could have been with two finer people on the subject. Thank you very much for your contribution.
Bless you. Thanks, Ken.
Thank you.
The White Horse Inn is a listener-supported broadcast. For more information about supporting our efforts, give us a call at 1-800-890-7556. That's 1-800-890-7556. You can also visit us online at whitehorseinn.org. That's whitehorseinn.org.